Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Study in the book of Leviticus. Leviticus is a very interesting book, but one that very few Christians ever spend much time in. It's a book that deals with really legislation for the Old Testament economy. Many parts of it seem so irrelevant and inapplicable. And I bet when you saw as a teacher that you were going to have to teach Leviticus 25, you thought, oh, yuck. Well, I think as you read it over, you realize there is some really neat things here. And although the specific applications may be different for our society, the motives and the universal principles that are behind the specific affirmations are universal to all cultures. If you have problems interpreting the Old Testament and applying it to our day, one of the best books that I know of is The Authority of the Old Testament by John Bright. And if you do much work in the Old Testament, that's a book you really want to get. It's available, I think, in paperback. The Authority of the Old Testament by John Bright. In Leviticus 25, we're going to be dealing with two primary Israelite applications of the 7 days of creation. One is the Sabbath year, and then the Sabbath year's Sabbath year, which we call year of Jubilee. It is very important that we see what is happening in the life of Israel and apply it to contemporary problems in our own day. To simply read this and interpret it in light of Israel's day is not going to bring the heart of this chapter home. And I really think there's a tremendous application to our day. Many people have, in recent years, have said the Old Testament is not historically accurate. And so much archaeological and historical research have been done in the ancient Mesopotamian cultures to try to see if the Bible does fit in historical continuity with the day in which it claims to be written. We have found parallels to these specific laws in Mesopotamian cultures from the 19th to the 17th centuries B.C. And I think that helps us to see the historicity of this account. Before I begin, I'd like for you to think about two primary antithesis that this chapter seems to balance. In our day, if we're not careful, we begin to baptize our economic structures as being Christian or the best available, and when in reality they're not. An example, capitalism. Capitalism can be a very selfish, a very utilitarian means of oppressing the poor of an elite class. And so this chapter critiques rampant capitalism. But it doesn't stop there. It also critiques rampant communism, or a welfare system where everybody is equal. The Bible is a unique book that shares the fact that God wants us to enjoy His creation. He wants our ingenuity and our creativity, and apparently us to benefit from that. But at the same time, He wants us to recognize that all things belong to Him, and we are simply stewards of what we have and who we are. With that in mind, then, let's begin in Leviticus chapter 25. The Lord spoke to Moses. If you notice the word Lord, it's all caps, which means Yahweh, the covenant name for God, from the Hebrew verb to be. Now, when it says at Mount Sinai, as you know, at Mount Sinai, the Israeli community was still a nomadic desert community. They were really not a nation yet. They were still a group or an aggregate of slaves. And yet this whole chapter is going to talk about the time when they are in the promised land and when they have a settled agricultural existence. So we're speaking about the future. And I think that's important that we look to a different time, a different sociological setting. Saying, speak to the sons of Israel. Now, the word Israel is used several ways in the Bible. It gets very confusing for people who don't spend a lot of time in the Old Testament. The word Israel primarily is the name that God gave to Jacob after he wrestled with the angel at the brook Jabbok. It is a sign that he became a different person in yielding to God and his will before he met his brother Esau, who he was afraid of. Now, because of that, and because Jacob was the primary patriarch who had the 12 sons, then the name Sons of Israel that's mentioned here becomes a designation for the whole tribe of the Jewish people. Sometimes it just says Israel, meaning all the Jews. But in 922 B.C., the monarchy split between Jeroboam and Rehoboam, and the 10 northern tribes became known as Ephraim or Israel or the northern tribes. And so if you're in those books about the later monarchy, Israel means the northern 10 tribes, in contradistinction from Judah and Benjamin of the southern 2 tribes. Here, of course, it means the children of Israel, the Jews. To say to them, when you come into the land which I shall give you, then the land shall have a Sabbath to the Lord. There is much made in the Old Testament about the 7 days of creation. 6 days God labored, on the 7th day he rested. In Exodus 20, it gives a religious reason for the Sabbath. In Deuteronomy 5, it gives a sociological reason for the Sabbath. Here, the Sabbath day rest is used in an agricultural setting as well as in a cycle of years for humanitarian purposes. It continues, verse 3. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyards and gather in its crops. But during the 7th year the land shall have a Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall not sow your field nor prune your vineyard. I think there are possibly 5 implications involved in the Sabbath year rest. Number 1, it shows that God is the owner of the land. You might want to see verse 23 where it says, "For all the land is mine." That reminds me of Exodus 19:5, where in God speaking of the Hebrew nation, he says, "You are a particular treasure among the peoples, for all the world is mine." This is a focusing down of that into the promised land. But in reality, everything that is belongs to God. And this is a way of showing that. Now, another thing I think is important, this is a good agricultural procedure. Today we have crop rotations and fertilizer supplementation, but they did not have that very much in the ancient world. Now, this is much like, I think, the food laws in the Old Testament. Many people see them as for health purposes. I see the food laws primarily for religious purposes that might happen to have some supplementary hygienic purposes. The same is true here. Basically, this is a religious institution. It may supplementary have good agricultural procedures built into it, but the primary purpose is not for good agriculture. It's for religious purposes. Number 3, it shows a trust in God's care and provision on a regular basis. They're not going to be able to sow or reap in these years. They're going to have to depend on God. Okay, number 4, it forces them to revert to the simple nomadic kind of lifestyle that their ancestors participated in their wilderness wanderings as they left Egypt. As they go back to this more simplistic lifestyle, they get back to their religious roots, and the great movement for the Hebrew people is the Exodus. Number 5, it was a test of obedience. It's very hard for those farmers to let that field lie. Very hard. But it was a command from their God. Now, in verse 6, it mentions, "And all of you shall have the Sabbath products," and I notice the word products, I'm using New American Standard, is in italics. Whenever a word in italics appears in your translation, it's trying to say it's not in the Hebrew text, but is supplied for an English reader to catch the gist of the Hebrew text, "of the land for food." This means that even large estates or landowners could not fence their land off. Now, even in normal times, Jews agriculturally did not revert to the corners of their field They left the gleanings for the poor. You might want to see the book of Ruth. But here, all the land belongs to all the people. And anyone could go anywhere and eat the produce that naturally grew. You know how you can't glean a field completely, and next year there's some seeds that sprout? That's what it's talking about. But where the grapes appeared, anybody could come in and eat those grapes that year because they were holy to the Lord that year. It's a way of signifying that the people are holy because all of them participate in what's available. Now, notice in verse 8. You are all able to count off 7 Sabbaths of years for yourself, 7 times 7 years, so that you have the time of 7 Sabbaths of years, namely 49 years.
Now, that Aaron shall cast lots.
The title of this is going to come, the year of Jubilee. Now, there is much misunderstanding about exactly how the 7th Sabbath year and the year of Jubilee are connected. Some see the 49th year as the 7th Sabbath, and the next year, the 50th year, as the year of Jubilee. But it seems very hard for me to believe there's 2 fallow years together. I probably, in my own understanding, see them being together in being the 49th year was not only the 7th Sabbath year, but also the year of Jubilee. There's been some theoretical postulation that maybe there is a specific year that only lasts 49 days, beginning at the Day of Atonement, which is in the 7th month. Now, this is said to be a year that gets the calendar back on schedule. We have something like that in our February 29th. So every 50 years, the Jews might have had a special short year that got the festival calendar back on track as a seasonal thing. We're just not sure about that. Now, notice what it mentions in verse 9. Then you shall sound the ram's horn abroad on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement, you shall sound the horn all through the land. Now, the zophar, or shofar, is a ram's horn. When I was in Israel, I tried to buy one, but they were so expensive. They're a certain horn of a certain animal. It's done by hand. They're very hard to blow, but they became a traditional sound for bringing in certain feast days. The Day of Atonement, you might want to see the 16th chapter of Leviticus, is the only set fast day in all of the Old Testament. The ritual is very involved with the high priest and the different offerings and sacrifices, the goat for Aziel, and on and on. It is a day when Israel corporately repents and offers sacrifices collectively for the people, except for those who sinned intentionally. Now, by the way, the word Jubilee is going to appear in verse 10. Let me just read it. You shall thus consecrate the 50th year and proclaim a release throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a Jubilee for you. And each one of you shall return his own property, return to his own property, and each of you shall return to his own family. Now, there's been much discussion about the etymology of the term Jubilee. In Hebrew, it seems to mean a protracted noise and came to be identified with the blowing of the ram's horn. But that etymology is not for certain because the Septuagint translation, the Greek translation, makes it mean release. And you see that word is also here in verse 10. Exactly what it means, I don't think we know. But obviously it's this special holiday that has to do with the 49th year or the small year or the 50th year. We're not sure which. Now when it says a release, back in Isaiah chapter 61 verse 1, this is one of the prophecies that relate to the Messiah. He should announce a release to the captives. It's also fulfilled in the life of Jesus in Luke chapter 4, verses 18 and 19. So you might want to see that as a messianic typology in this chapter. When it says, each of you shall return to his own property, one of the purposes of the year of Jubilee is that there be no landed aristocracy in Israel, that every 50 years the land would automatically revert to the original tribal ownership. As you know, the land was divided among the tribes by lot. and every tribe received a certain part. Every 50 years, they were to go back to that original tribal allocation, and every slave was to return to their own family or be released. This was the humanitarian purpose, to help the debtors get a fresh start and not to develop a rich class and a poor class among the people of Israel. And I think you can see the purpose there. In Numbers 36:9, we have the ideal about returning to our own family. In Isaiah chapter 5, verse 8, we see that a rich class did develop in Israel that tried to put land to land and vineyard to vineyard and caused great problems, as it has in every country in the world where greed has dominated human need. Now, notice what it mentions. Let's see. Let me skip down to verse 18 if I could. So you shall thus observe my statutes, keep my judgments, so as to carry them out, that you may live securely in the land. Now in chapter 26, verses 3 through 13, the blessings of keeping God's law are specifically delineated, and you might want to see that next chapter. The blessings for observing this would be that God would provide peace and security in the promised land. Notice where it mentions in verse 20, but if you say, what are we going to eat on the seventh year if we do not sow or gather in our crops? Here's the very utilitarian attitude of man that says, what are we going to eat, God? Well, I think the same attitude is picked up on when Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 6, verses 19 through 34, talks about the lilies of the field, the birds of the air, being anxious for your lifespan, being anxious what you shall eat and what you shall wear. And the implication of that is, if you trust God first, He'll provide all the rest you need. That's exactly what this is talking about, and may have been the background for Jesus' statement there. Notice it says in verse 21, and so I will order my blessings for you in the sixth year, that it will bring forth the crops for 3 years. Now, people who have a closed system of natural law and do not allow a personal sovereign God to intervene in His creation will find it very hard to believe that every 6 years there was a huge bumper crop. And yet those of us who believe in a personal God who stands by His word and blesses His children when they obey will have no problems in believing this, because the crop was directly related to the rain, and God, of course, is the provider of the rain. Verse 23. The land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine, God says, for you are but aliens and sojourners with me. In reality, all the possessions of man belong to God, and we are stewards of them, and God needs to bring that home to our mind. In reality, we can't buy and sell land permanently even today, for when a man dies, it passes to his children. But in reality, the land belongs to God. No one owns anything. We are simply stewards. And the unfortunate nature of our society is that people too often are treated as means to an end, not people as the priority in all the world. Things are not the priority. People are the priority. Now, when it says here that we are aliens and sojourners with God, that's a beautiful statement, that not only are we aliens and sojourners, but God is a pilgrim with us through this world. You might want to see Hebrews chapter 11, verse 13, and 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 11. I like the song that this world is not my home, I'm just passing through. It's a tragedy beyond tragedy when God's people drive the tent pegs of their lives down into the soil of this world, when in reality this world is not their home. Everything we put our lives into here is going to pass away, and the only thing that has ultimate reality is what we do for God. To put it in terms of the Sermon on the Mount, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust and thief, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. For there, where you put your treasure, your priority, your energies, your talents, your time, your creativity, there will your heart be also. Where is your heart, my friend? It continues then in verse 24, where it says, for thus every piece of your property you are to provide for the redemption of the land. Notice in verse 25, if a fellow countryman of yours becomes so poor he has to sell part of his property, his nearest kinsman is to come and buy back what his relative has sold. This is the biblical concept of the goel. We find it in Ruth chapter 4 and Jeremiah 32:7 and following. It is often a title for God Himself. It is that aspect where of the responsibilities that families have for one another. In the New Testament, even, this is emphasized that if a widow has a family, they should provide for her and not the church. In our day, he claims to be such a wonderful, intellectual, enlightened society, a civilized group of people. We treat our old people horrendously. I want to say to you, it is a priority commitment from God that we take care of our families and those who are in our family groups. We have a responsibility to God. In the New Testament, it's emphasized more and more, too. Here, the goel is the near kin, the closest kin that comes in to help his family member out of a strait. God is considered to be our near kin. The names for God, like father or husband or parent, is like the word near kin. It emphasizes the close, intimate, personal relationship between God and his people. Now, notice if you would. Well, before I get to verse 29 and following, 29 is going to deal with the walled cities. 35 is going to deal with the country. There are several distinctions made. In the walled cities, if someone sold their property, they had to be redeemed in 1 year or it was gone permanently. And then we come in verse 32 to talk about the cities of the Levites, or the Levitical cities. In the division of the land, every tribe got a part of the allocation except the tribe of Levi, which, of course, the priest came out of. They received certain cities around the nation called Levitical cities. Many of them were also cities of refuge where an Israelite, if he killed somebody by accident, could flee to, and the blood avenger, which is also the goel, the near kinsman, could not kill him, and he had to stay there until the death of the high priest, and then he was free. We see that in Numbers 35, verses 1 through 8, and Joshua 21, verses 1 through 42, the allocation of these cities. The pasture land around these cities were given to the Levites. The reason that Levites could not sell permanently their land is because soon there'd be no cities of refuge. So as a special stipulation for these Levites. Then in verse 35, we come to another stipulation about the unwalled villages and the time and manner of redemption there. In verse 36, we have an interesting, I think, discussion in light of our own day, and that says, "Do not take a usurious interest from him, but revere your God, for your countrymen may live with you. And you shall give him your silver, you shall not give him your silver at interest, nor your food for gain. I am the Lord." Now, it's significant that that God would not allow the Jewish people to make money off their poor brother. I'm not saying that interest is out of the will of God, because our society is based on different motive and form of economy, and our society runs on the concept of credit. But I would say that in the modern world, when men take advantage of the poor and do not give them the dignity of being human and do not provide the things of life for them except at exorbitant costs, I want you to know you're going to stand before God for our abuse of poor people. I want you to let it be known that God is not mocked, and that whatsoever men sow in their greed and their abuse of the poor and the alienated and the socially outcast, they are going to reap from God. The whole book of Deuteronomy says, "I am the defender of the orphan and the widow and the alien," says God. If you're going to pick on somebody, my friend, pick on somebody rich. You better leave the poor alone and the underprivileged. It's best to help them at cost to yourself, not so you'll feel better, but in honor of the God that gave you what you have. And so the usury law, I don't think, can apply directly to our interest rates, although the motive of greed is a problem that men have always had and always will have. Notice we're down in verse 39. Well, let me go to verse, where do I want to go to? Let me try 38. Notice where the land of Egypt comes back in again. God's saying, you ought to act this way because I dealt with you in grace. I brought you as a slave nation. Everything you have, you owe to me, God's saying. Now, because of that, and because you're mine, I want you to live a certain way, a different way, a unique way. The idea of love your neighbor as yourself comes from the book of Leviticus. And this is a practical expression of that in the lives, the daily lives. How would you like it if every 50 years all the land reverted back to the original owners of the United States? You say, oh, horrendous. We can't do that, of course, because the land hadn't been divided out by God. But I say to you, do you ever give the guy a break? Do you ever take a loss because you're a Christian? Do you ever bend over backwards economically because of who you are in Christ? Sometimes the deal about, well, that's just business. That's a failed smokescreen for pure, unbridled, godless greed. In verse 39, and if a countryman of yours becomes so poor in regard to he sells himself, now 39 and really following deals with slavery in the Hebrew community. A Hebrew could buy another Hebrew for a debt, but he had to treat him like a brother. And notice in verse 41 where it says, he shall go out from you. In Leviticus 21:2 and Deuteronomy 15:12 it says that you can sell your slave to a person you owe for 6 years, but the seventh year you're to let him go free. Then in verse 43 it says, you shall not rule over him severely, but you are to revere your God. The way you treat your slave reflects who you are, is what it's saying. In Ephesians chapter 6, verses 5 through 9, Paul, I think, reflects on this as he talks about how slaves should serve their masters as the Lord, but how masters should not be harsh with their slaves. I think it's very important the way we treat one another. Maybe in our day, the analogy of employer and employee is somewhat analogous to this, although not specifically. I think it's true that how we treat people who depend on us for a living, how we act as managers, and how we work faithfully as employees is caught up in who we are in Jesus Christ. It's very, very important, I think, the principle that whatever we do as unto the Lord. If we dig a ditch, we dig it as to the Lord. If we are president of a corporation, we do it as to the Lord. The profit motive is not the God of this world. Now, many have, looking at 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verse 21, that deals with the time of Jeremiah and the exile, seem to imply the year of Jubilee was never instituted in the land of Israel. The historical information is too vague, and we can't be sure, but it may be that the Jews never did this thing. The principles here are good. They're thought-provoking. They bring judgment to our lives of greed and selfishness. God bless you. I've enjoyed being with you.